on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Yes, a big thank you to Laura Fox for another entertaining afternoon. It is Thursday, the 24th of February. I'm Shane Dawson, and this is Game On. Coming up this evening, sport has its say on the headline news of the day.
I woke up with this morning's news and shocked. I think it's horrible to see what is happening. And obviously, if you look at the calendar, we have a race scheduled in Russia. For myself, my own opinion is I should not go, I will not go. I'm sorry for, you know, innocent people that are losing their lives, that are getting killed for stupid reasons, and a very, very strange and mad leadership.
Yes, Sebastian Vettel, one of the many global sports stars, expressing the shock many of us felt this morning. Meanwhile, in studio, we'll be joined by Bernard Jackman on Six Nations Rugby and indeed the URC with Leinster in action this evening. And Paul Corry will be in to chat all things association football. Plus, we'll hear from Kerry star Paddy Clifford. And if that wasn't enough, we'll also hear from Jeff Shepherd, who has his eye on America, as always. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at Game On.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there. It is great to have your company wherever you are tuning in from on this Thursday evening. Shane Dawson here. You're listening to Game on 2FM. A couple of headlines that have caught our eye, myself and Paul Corry's eye, I should say, who's joining me in studio this evening. Obviously, the headline news, Paul, is all surrounding Russia and Ukraine. And you heard the news there shortly before we came on air and everything. But from a sporting perspective, I suppose. I mentioned Sebastian Vettel, and I think himself and Max Verstappen have called on Russia to be removed from the Formula One calendar as fury mounts over the invasion of Ukraine. Vettel said he will not race at the Russian Grand Prix in Sochi, as you heard there, which is scheduled for September 25th if it does take place as planned. F1 said in a statement they were closely watching the very fluid developments, while Istanbul has reportedly emerged as a potential replacement on the calendar. Now, the FAI released a statement that they're keeping a watch on developments in terms of the fixture that Ireland will be due to play Ukraine, of course, on the 14th of June in the UEFA Nations League that's currently scheduled to be played in Lviv. And sticking with football, Paul, it is expected that UEFA will move this year's Champions League final from St. Petersburg in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. UEFA President Alexander Seferin has called an extraordinary meeting of the Executive Committee tomorrow morning, and it is expected to agree on moving the final. The showcase match in European club football was set to be held at Zenit St. Petersburg Stadium on May 28, an event that would have normally drawn thousands of fans from across the continent. The stadium is known as the Gazprom Stadium after a sponsorship deal with Russia's state energy company, which also sponsors UEFA's Champions League and UEFA's Euro 2024 national team competition. A group of European lawmakers wrote to UEFA today asking for it to change the venue and to stop considering Russian cities for international football competitions. And the football associations of Poland, Sweden and the Czech Republic have said today that Russia should not be allowed to host World Cup qualifiers next month. Listen, I don't want to get too bogged down in this, Paul, but listen, across the board, you have F1, you have football, and I'm sure other sporting organisations that will arise, that it's very difficult to know what happened, and it's very concerning as well.
Yeah, it's only a matter of time, Shane. Only a matter of time with regards to when that venue will be changed. It's not if, it's when, and UEFA will certainly have to intervene and change what is a very unpredictable and unsafe situation over in Russia at this moment in time. I was at the Champions League during the week, and I saw the Gazprom ads going around the pitch, and I was wondering, you know, will it be a case that all sorts of associations with Russia will eventually be pulled? So, yeah, it's a very sad situation. It's very difficult to watch on the television, and for UEFA, it is only a matter of time before they change it and pull that final and change to another venue. They had to do last year with Porto having to come in and host given the situation with COVID, so they've certainly plenty of time this time around, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, certainly. And I suppose if we're to move the conversation onto football and to look at the European football this week, and one of the headlines on the BBC website, I think it was, the government should seize the assets of Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich, a Labour MP has said, citing concerns about alleged links to corruption. So, you know, it's wide ranging in terms of how this will affect sport. And I know you were over in Stamford Bridge this week. I know we reviewed the match yesterday, Chelsea-Lille, but in terms of the atmosphere over there, was there any, listen, I know it was on Tuesday, any disharmony, or was it all just about the football and it was just business as normal over at Chelsea?
It seemed to be business as usual, Shane, and you know, those Champions League games and any of the games that I've gone to involve in any of the top four teams, it's hit and miss when it comes to atmosphere. It is a bit of a tourist occasion and a bit of a day out for a number of different people who are visiting the stadium, and you don't tend to be in with the diehards who sit beside or sit behind either goal. But it was good. It was a good game. Chelsea started very quickly, very well. The one thing that I would say about this level of football when you get to this stage of the Champions League is, you know, you watch League of Ireland on a consistent basis, you slowly start to realise there are definitely levels to this game, just particularly when you see somebody like Thiago Silva, 37, 38 years of age and cruise controlled, whose reading of the game, his anticipation, his distribution, absolutely everything about his performance was top class. N'Golo Kante similar as well. Chelsea weren't incredible. I've certainly seen them better, but they did enough, and Lille very much you know, a team that you would expect them to beat and somebody who aren't probably going to prevent them from getting to the next round. But a nice occasion out, nice to be there for the Champions League music at the beginning. But yeah, I mean, you don't feel as connected as when you watch a League of Ireland game.
Yeah, you big up Thiago Silva there, so I suppose my retort to that would be like a young Kevin Doherty, N'Golo Kante like a young Stewie Byrne maybe. No, listen, there's comparisons all over. We are keeping an eye, or well, we're both keeping an eye, Paul, a close eye on Bodo Glimt and Celtic. Celtic had it all to do heading over there. It is 23 minutes in, and unfortunately, Paul, they are 1-0 down Solbakken with a 9th-minute goal. From an Irish perspective, Liam Scales started, but I don't want to be too critical. You know, I'm a big fan of Liam Scales, but was caught out somewhat for the goal.
Yeah, potentially. I think first and foremost, Bodo Glimt are a very good side. I think they showed that last week when they played in Glasgow and they won 3-1. The way they moved the ball around probably caught people a bit by surprise. But the you know, the goal was, I guess, similar to what we would have seen last week. Worked well through the thirds. Liam Scales probably not renowned for his 1-1 defending, Shane, and he got stood up on the edge of the box. It was a lovely step inside from Solbakken onto his left foot, and he just guided past Joe Hart. So tie well and truly over at this stage, given the fact that they won the first leg 3-1, and Celtic have an important game against Hibs this weekend. There were 6 changes of squad. Did he have one eye on that? Had he maybe bitten the bullet and said you too much of a gap to recover from last week? It certainly felt that way with the changes that were involved, but you know, hopefully they can make something of it. But at this moment in time, Bodo Glimt looked a far better side.
Yeah, certainly do seem to be on top. 4-1 on aggregate, as I did mention there. Leicester are 1-up away to Rangers. Partizan Belgrade are 2-up, and Marseille are 1-up away at Carabag. But we'll keep you up to date with the score in the Celtic match. But Paul, Champions League last night, and I suppose only one place to start, Mr. Anthony Elanga and Manchester United. And I was watching the match, and yes, it was a good result. They didn't play well, and they'll go home and regroup, go back to Carrington and say, okay, we may have got away with that, and we can build on it. And David Snaid was in studio last night and was kind of giving the ins and outs on Manchester United and how it may affect them. Does this somewhat positive result, will it paper over the cracks? Because, you know, as a 90-minute performance, you know, you'd be concerned, to say the least, if you're a Manchester United fan.
Well, Atletico Madrid certainly aren't the powerhouse that they have been in European football over the last number of years. But in the first 5, 10, 15 minutes, they were quick out of the blocks. And that's hardly surprising. They're always like that when they're at home. Simeone gets the home fans behind the squad. They press very quickly. They press high up the pitch. And Manchester United, for the first 20 minutes in particular, they were really struggling. They couldn't get out of their half. They couldn't get a foothold of possession, and you feared the worst for them. And particularly when João Felix scored that first, you maybe thought that there might be another before half time. It looked as if there was only one side in that tie. And some of the individual performances from Manchester United, just looking at a couple of players, Rashford was diabolical, Shane. Pogba, really poor. Fernandes' use of the ball was terrible. Luke Shaw, you know, Harry Maguire gets a lot of stick, but Luke Shaw over the last couple of months has been equally as bad. And even the passage of play where De Gea rolled it out to Varane, Varane hadn't even realised that he'd given it to him. He turned it around the corner to Sancho. Varane then coughed up possession, and Atletico Madrid, I think, hit the post from that chance. So they were very lucky to go in at half time, only one behind, but with this Man U team, when you feel like they're on the floor, they seem to find something. And the changes certainly worked. He took Rashford off, he took Sancho off, Pogba off, and Luke Shaw off. And it certainly gave them a bit more going forward. They grew into the game. And to be fair to them, it was a well-worked goal. I thought Fred's ball around the corner to Fernandes was very good. Fernandes, typically, when he gets into those positions, finds the right pass, and he did so on this occasion. You could question Oblak's positioning. He was very far over. You, as a goalkeeper, might be able to give
some. I'm glad you brought that up, not me, because I was that was my follow-up question. I was trying to think in my head there. It goes, not often do we want to criticise goalkeepers, but
he was very far over.
He what? No, I think this time, yeah, criticism is just.
Yeah, and Alanga didn't catch it too well. You know, he kind of scuffed it and hit it into the ground, but he did what you would expect him to do, is go across goal. He found the bottom corner, and they get out of there with a really good result. Alanga was the difference probably when it came off. He showed a willingness to run in behind. He brings, there's energy to his game, and he seems like he's enjoying himself. And I heard Ragnar's interviews afterwards, and he was saying, I kind of hope the rest of the players would find that enjoyment in the game as well. So they get back to Old Trafford in good stead. I fancied them even before last night to get through that tie. Something tells me that Manchester United will reach semi-finals. I just feel like they're going to get a favourable draw in the quarters and nick their way through. But if they are to do that, and if they are to have any chance in this competition, it's certainly got to be a better performance than they showed last night.
Yeah, touching on Anthony Elanga, how good is he, or is he just looking like he's a world-class superstar because others around him aren't performing as well?
It's probably a bit of both. He certainly has talent. He's definitely got something, and he's tricky, he's quick, he's direct. And when you're a fullback, that's never easy to play against. And he certainly gives them a dynamic in that sense. Like Rashford seems to want to come to the ball, Sancho as well. He's got that raw electric pace that will take him past players. There's certainly a case for saying that he's standing out amongst some average performances. I kind of owned in on Rashford already. He's been poor for a number of months. Ronaldo and Fernandes are different types of players, so he gives them that different dimension. And when you get young players coming into a team, they don't tend to overthink things. They're a bit raw and they're just a bit edgy, and they can get at people, and that's very unpredictable to play against as a fullback. But the confidence that he's shown, that wasn't an easy game to come into last night. It's a tense atmosphere in Madrid. They were 1-0 down. You could kind of see the confidence on the floor. He certainly gave them something different. And if you continue in that vein, he's still only 19 years of age, and he's scoring goals as well, which is important for a wide player. If he can continue doing that, you could make a case and an argument for him starting some of these games.
Yeah, and you mentioned he's raw on the pitch and kind of he just goes about his job. Listening to his interview after was so refreshing. He was just so honest, and he was just so jovial and joyous just to be playing, because we've had this conversation on the show before and with other people in studio as well, that you just, if you're a Manchester United fan, you just want players to play for the shirt. You want to show that bite and heart. And I know I posed the question to David last night, of more tongue in cheek, about the Booms back, big win over Leeds, Bruno giving all positive quotes, Ragnik on the pitch giving it the fist pumps to the away fans and everything. Problems, what problems? But seeing Elanga actually put it in and enjoy himself as well, I mean, that's great to see.
You could see him when he scored the goal, he didn't quite know what to do with himself. He was running everywhere. You could nearly sense the adrenaline just flowing through his body. But I think Manchester United fans had suffered so much in the last number of years, whether it be their manager, whether it be their players, they're just crying out for honesty. They're crying out for honesty in interviews. You know, the same sort of garbage is regurgitated after bad performances, whether it be Harry Maguire, Luke Shaw, you could name a number of them. They just want honesty. And you kind of get the feeling that whether Ragnik is doing a good job or an average job, or he's just continued the job that Solskjaer is doing, his interviews lend to honest assessments of people and of players. Happened with Martial. He said he didn't want to travel. He's called players out at different moments in time. He's certainly not getting all the decisions right, but there is an honesty that people are finding refreshing, and that then lends itself to the players as well. There's too many times that you look at Manchester United players and the heads are down, they're sulking, the body language is all over the place. If you can almost use Alanga's energy and his positivity and hope that that is infectious throughout the squad, you might get them up another gear.
Yeah, definitely. And you spoke about him rising to the big occasion as well. When you have someone like Diego Simeone barking at you from the sideline as well. Do you have any opposition managers back in your day trying to give you a bit of stick back when you were younger as well, up and coming, trying to put you off?
My debut was against Leeds, and it was Neil Warnock.
Oh, okay, say no more.
Yeah, yeah. It probably doesn't get much deeper than that. And there's a few shows I wouldn't be able to murmur on radio that went towards it. Michael Brown was playing against me, and I'd done well in the first half, and there was certainly
motivation.
Yeah, exactly.
Benfica Ajax 2-1, one for the purists we were joking about yesterday, two European heavyweights as well. Sebastian Haller has rejuvenated himself as well. He did get an own goal, but he redeemed himself a couple of minutes later. 2-1 finally poised for the return leg. Obviously no away goals to contend with, but it's nice to see. I know I refer to soccer as association football, and maybe half tongue in cheek, half tongue in serious, but it's nice to see the likes of Benfica and Ajax pushing on, you know, clubs from Portugal and Holland, that it's not always your Manchester United's and your big spenders, your European Super League, if we're allowed to say that. That's not a banned term.
Yeah, like Ajax, when they got to the Champions League semi-final that time against Tottenham, you probably would have thought it was going to be a once-off, but they're producing now on a consistent basis in Europe. And last night, I was just watching the highlights back, they could have been out of sight in that game. You mentioned Sebastian Haller there, who's in ripe form, scored again last night. There was another one that actually ricocheted off the post from 5 yards, he could have stuck in, that would have put them 3-1 up in the tie. There was some really dubious defending. You know, the own goal was really poor from Haller. I thought he could have moved his feet quicker, and Yarmouchuk, his equaliser, was poor from the goalkeeper. He parried it just into the middle of the 6-yard box when he should have touched it around the corner. But Ajax are always a good watch going forward. Tadic's goal was super. Anthony, the Brazilian on the wing, is really exciting. There's certainly more to him, so it'll be interesting to see who goes through in that tie, particularly given there's no away goals. It was open last night, I'd expect it to be open next week again. And if Ajax in particular were to go through, they're a bit of a sticky opposition for anybody in that quarter final.
Absolutely. There was three Premier League matches as well. And speaking of honesty and honest interviews, I want to start our Premier League review chat by playing a clip from Conte after the defeat, 1-0 Burnley against Spurs. And it's not going well for Tottenham fans.
Four defeats in the last 5 games. This is the first time in my life that happened this type of situation. Maybe I'm not so good. I think Tottenham called me to improve the situation, but I'm too honest to close my eyes, you understand? And to continue to tell, okay, but I want to finish my season in this way, and okay, but my salary is good. No, but I'm not this type of person. I have ambition. I'm a person that I have ambition. I hate to lose, and we lost. I repeat, 4 games in the last 5 games. This is unacceptable. And I want to accept this. And I want to try to move the situation, also to make assessment with the club. Because if we continue this way, and we can finish 10, 12, 13.
So, what do you make of that?
Can we get Stephen Kelly to dial in? I love talking about Tottenham when Stephen Kelly's here as a Chelsea fan. Tottenham doing what Tottenham do best, you know, and a great win against Man City, and Conte's talking about the players and saying that they're some of the most honest players that he's worked with, an appetite and a hunger to get better. And then you fast forward to Wednesday, and they've been beaten 1-0 away to Burnley, who are really struggling towards the bottom of the table. In my eyes, it's a bit of a ticking time bomb there. You've got a manager who's hungry, who simply wants to win, wants to compete, has fallen out with clubs in the past when they haven't backed him. And when you match Conte with somebody like Daniel Levy, who's a shrewd operator who will not invest heavily in his squad, he's poured millions into the stadium, he probably wants to see a bit of a return on investment on that, has kept Harry Kane. With that in mind, he hasn't really put a lot of money into his team. Conte obviously wants investment. He wants to build around what he already has, and he probably felt that particularly over the Christmas transfer window. Couple of good results in the lead up into that, not backed in the transfer window, frustrated. It's only a matter of time before he's out of Tottenham.
Will he be pushed or will he walk? I suppose that's a very financial question as well. It's not as simple as that, but it's I was going to say it's bizarre. It probably is. It's not common to hear someone kind of come out with that. And I suppose there's a bit of broken English as well in certain terminologies and everything. But it's nice to see that passion, I suppose.
Yeah, usually it's the chief executive and the chairman who are assessing the manager about whether or not they're going to keep him on. It sounds like Conte's flipped that around and he's saying there needs to be assessments across the board. It just goes hand in hand with Conte, and he doesn't tend to last too long in the one place. And he fell out with Chelsea. There was a big falling out with Diego Costa and the Brazilian crew, and that led to him being forced out the door. Similarly, again, into Milan, he didn't feel as if he was going to get the investment to take them to the next level. He's got a kick out of Tottenham. He's certainly put them in a much better position than they were under Nuno. But you just don't see that as being a match made in heaven between himself and Levy. Levy is so shrewd in his negotiations. He's so shrewd about how much money he spends on his playing squad. Conte wants to win things. Levy's more than happy to finish in the top six every year. It's just not going to last. Will it be a case that Conte will walk or Levy will sack him? That probably comes down to the whole financial package. You could easily see, by mutual consent, come the end of the season. He'll probably wait until the end of the season, but I just can't see it being a relationship that's going to last too long.
Wouldn't mind being a fly on the wall there. We've all seen the Spurs documentary. It would be interesting to see how Conte would be handling things as opposed to Jose Mourinho when he was there. It is still 1-0 to Bodø/Glimt against Celtic, but we were somewhat criticising Liam Scales earlier after making a wonderful block there. Joe Hart actually with an unbelievable save, and then the follow-up by a Bodø/Glimt striker was deflected out for a corner by Liam Scales. So still 1-0. Down Celtic are indeed with playing on a pitch with snow on the sidelines as well, so fairly cold over there. Couple of other Premier League matches just to continue the narrative of managers under pressure. Liverpool 6 Leeds United 0. Obviously Leeds took the derby defeat, could you call it? War of the Roses anyway at the weekend to Manchester United. So two big defeats in a row for Leeds, against, granted now, against extremely good opposition, but Marco Bielsa under a bit of pressure.
It's hard to say he's under pressure given what he's done with limited resources at Leeds, but they're certainly tumbling down the table, and they don't look on the basis of the last two games like they're going to turn around. They are leaking goals, Shane, at this moment in time. Just looking at the table here, they've conceded 56 all season, which is the most, three more than Norwich. And when you've got that against your name, and when you're struggling for confidence and struggling for goals, that always worries me looking at a side. And you know, with Burnley winning back-to-back games, there's now only 3 points between themselves and Leeds with two games in hand. So they're certainly under pressure. Whether Bielsa's under pressure or the players are under pressure, the club in itself is certainly in a precarious position, and there's every chance that they could get pulled into that relegation dogfight. The only hope for Leeds is that they produce results out of nowhere, and they can be a stiff opposition on their day for other teams. You'd be hoping that the likes of Bamford and Calvin Phillips will find fitness and get back into that team and give them another level. Brentford is another one who sit just above Leeds who I'd be really worried for. They are, since the turn of Christmas, in free fall as well. So there's certainly a few teams that could be dragged back into that. From Brentford down, any one of those teams could be in trouble. Everton and Newcastle picked up a bit of form, kind of maybe suspect that they are, well, Everton haven't, but I'm kind of waiting for them to pick bit of form, or they showed a decent performance against Brentford. They could potentially pull away from it, but there's probably four or five there that you could look at for that last relegation spot.
Absolutely, and Thomas Frank and Marco Bielsa have done so well with Brentford and Leeds, would be unfortunate to see them get the boot, as I said. And I stutter in my sentence because Celtic, I've just missed the opportunity to draw a level, free kick whipped in, and Carl Starfelt, I think it is, with the shot, who's just over the bar. Paul Corrick, to save me doing it, we're going to keep you here for the hour. You're going to be on Celtic watch, and we're going to turn our attention from association football to rugby football. Stay with us, because Bernard Jackman will be live in studio next.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM with Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Rugby.
Yes, hello once again. You're very welcome back to Game On on this Thursday evening. I'm Shane Dawson and I'm in the company now of Bernard Jackman as we turn our attention to rugby. Paul Corry is still live in studio. He's keeping a watch on the Celtic match that's on at the moment. It's currently 1-0 to Bodo Glimt. Celtic trailing 4-1 on aggregate. It is a couple of minutes away from half time. But Bernard Jackman, welcome along. Big weekend of Six Nations to look forward to. Obviously, we don't know the Ireland team yet, so let's focus on what we do know. First up on Saturday is Scotland versus France. For France, Jonathan Dante returns to the French side for Saturday's showdown with Scotland at Murrayfield in the only personnel change from the team that defeated Ireland in Paris last time out. The Stade Francais centre takes the place of Gavin Villiers, who has been ruled out with a fractured sinus. First time I've seen that injury written down. For Scotland, the inclusion of the 22-year-old Glasgow flanker Rory Darge, who made his international debut as a replacement against Wales in Cardiff earlier this month, represents one of three changes, all on the forward line to the starting 15 that defeated started the defeat at the Principality last time out. Magnus Bradbury will start his first game for Scotland since 2020, and Xander Fagerson are the other two players added to Gregor Townsend's starting lineup. WP Nail, Johnny Gray and Matt Fagerson are the three players to drop out. France, obviously the only team that can still get a Grand Slam. Will that be the case after this match is played?
Look, it's a tough game. Scotland have been very good, competitive against France over the last three or four occasions. I think Scotland had a great win against England, but then underperformed against Wales. But I think they are a good side and have got a lot of depth, and they'll certainly put France's pin or collar. France have been at home, you know, in November, first two games at home. So it's a test for them to go to Murrayfield. This is packed stadium. And they may come unstuck. And obviously, from an Irish point of view, we have to hope that they do slip up, and that losing bonus point we got in Paris could become crucial. But I suspect that France just might have enough. I think they're on a really good upward curve. They're building confidence, and they'll see the match against Scotland as the next step for them in terms of ticking off little milestones, a big win away from home. So I think it'll be very tight, but I fancy France. Just the individuals they have and the power they have up front, particularly off the bench, could be enough.
How big a factor will that home advantage? Because I think France are looking for their first win in Murrayfield since 2014. And I know when you see these stats, it's not like they're playing them every single year and so on. But in terms of, we mentioned before, Ireland-France and kind of trying to silence that partisan crowd and try and get a foothold in the game. On the flip side for France now, how big an advantage will it be for Scotland?
Yeah, look, I think it is a big advantage. But I'm factoring the fact that this French team have matured a lot. You know, the whole narrative about French teams on travel is starting to change. You know, there's a backbone of Toulouse players who've gone away from home to win a European Cup. They have had some victories away from home with France. And Galtier and the coaching staff are a very modern coaching staff. There's ambition within the squad. They're working towards a World Cup. And to win a Grand Slam or a Six Nations would be a brilliant confidence booster for them. So I think it obviously is going to be difficult, but I think that we have to say this French team have become more consistent over the last year, and potentially they're good enough to go and win anyway.
Absolutely. Okay, there's one other fixture on the Saturday before we get to Ireland and Italy. It is indeed England-Wales, which you can see live on RT television. England enter their pivotal Six Nations match against Wales with Manu Tuilagi and Courtney Laws restored to the team following spells out through injury. In an unexpected twist, Bernard, Ben Youngs must surpass Jason Leonard's record as England's most capped player as a replacement due to Harry Randall continuing at starting at scrum half. Youngs was expected to be restored at 9 after being demoted for the 5-try route of Italy in Rome, but he will win his 115th cap off the bench before a full house at Twickenham. For Eddie Jones, how would you rate, I suppose, England this Six Nations so far, and what should we expect to see come this weekend?
Look, they were very close against Scotland, blew it really, and he brought on George Ford to close out the game, and the opposite happened. Scotland just got complete control. George Ford hardly got a touch. I think it was the right decision at the time. Marcus Smith is key to England. He was very good against Scotland. He was excellent against Italy. He's probably the best attacking 10 in the competition, and that's where the future lies. And I think he feels matching Harry Rendell and Marcus Smith together, it just gives him so much, so many attacking threats put around the ruck and a little bit further out. So I can see the reason behind that. Also, Eddie Jones is the master of this period. You know, 18 months before World Cup cycle, finding out what he has. He wants to find out if Harry Rendell has the ability to, you know, be his number one. And I think this maybe we'll come on to our Ireland chat in a second. But and also, I think from an English point of view, having Courtney Laws and Manitou Laggy back is a game changer. They're both, you know, top players, really experienced. Manu Tagalagi has become, when he plays for either Sale, British and Irish Lions, or England, he's a game winner. So I think England aren't, there's not much hype about them. They're under the radar a little bit. They've found some new talent, they're continuing to try and find more, and I think they'll get the job done against Wales and could yet be a contender at the business end of this championship.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how that pans out. And indeed, with Laws and Tuilagi back, are a massive boost for England, and indeed Eddie Jones. From a Welsh perspective, Wayne Pivac has left out wing Louis Rhys-Zammit and recalled number 8 Talipe Faletau for Saturday's game. I suppose let's start with the omission, because yeah, on paper, to me, from the casual viewer, like, that's a big shock. Is it the right call? Is it the wrong call?
I think it's the wrong call. I think for Wales to go to Twickenham and test England, put them under pressure, stress them a little bit, they need players like Rhys-Zammit. I know that Wayne Pivac is paired back on the type of game he probably got the Welsh job on, which was based around the Scarlets all attack. He thinks international rugby is a little bit harder to play that expansive type of game. But yet Rhys-Zammit, you know, last year when Wales won the Six Nations, he scored, I think, 2 crucial tries from a long range out. He's just unbelievable speed, pace. He worries defenders, and I think Eddie Jones will be sleeping a lot easier the fact that he's not in the squad.
Mm. And it is a case of he won't even be involved around in the build-up, because, as is the case with players for Wales who are playing club rugby in England, they'll be released back to them, and then he'll be in the match day 23, Gloucester taking on Leicester on Saturday as well. So he's not even around the environment, I suppose, around the Welsh camp as well. He's replaced by fit again Josh Adams, with Alex Cuthbert retained on the other wing and set to win his 50th cap. So yeah, bit of a strange one, I suspect. Listen, Bernard, obviously we won't have concrete Irish team news until tomorrow, so all we can do is get mere speculation and your inside expert knowledge and view and where you feel the changes might come. Obviously Ian Henderson ruled out with COVID. Ronan Kelleher, we know, is missing out as well. Tom O'Toole, who might have saw a bit of game time, has a hamstring issue as well. Johnny Sexton was up doing media saying he's good to go. So let's, I suppose, start with the out half. Johnny Sexton says he's good to go. He's been put up for media. Does that mean?
Well, yeah, historically under Farrell, the player sent forward for media has been a really good clue as a selection. But I suppose with Johnny being captain, and him having been out against France, maybe they just wanted to set him out to kind of set the message. I hope he doesn't play, and that's I hope Johnny plays against England and Scotland. I think he's a key man for Ireland, but I think this is a great opportunity to give Joey Carberry another 60 minutes, and then I would also not even have Johnny on the bench, because I would like to see Jack Carty get a proper amount of game time. You know, it's very difficult for him, obviously. I think he played a couple of minutes against France, but I think his form for Connacht has been good enough. I think we need to know we have 3 10s and what they can do, but also for them to know that Farrell trusts in them too. And if he doesn't trust them to get a job done against Italy, it's hard to believe he has to trust in him to go into a quarterfinal of a World Cup, etc. So that's how I would play it. I think Johnny, you know, some people say Johnny needs game time. He hasn't been out for very long. He's become very good at coming in from 2 or 3 weeks off and hitting the ground running straight away. And there's no game next weekend, so he can do a lot of conditioning with the conditioning coaches over the next week to get that match-like preparation. So for me personally, I would use this as an opportunity to give Joey Carberry more time in the saddle and Jack Carty. But look, maybe Faz is going to go for a safe bet.
So you wouldn't read too much into, I suppose, the narrative and the argument that if Johnny doesn't play, that means he's had the gap week, he's had a match week, and then a couple of gap weeks before that England match.
a player of Johnny Sexton, of who has his experience and knows he can manage his body as well. He's long enough in the game to be around that, and he's got the right people around him as well, that he doesn't need the game time. He'll be able to just step up to the mark and be 100% when he's needed.
100%, and that's the way his career has been over the last 2 years. He hasn't had to play every week to be very influential, and because this is only a minor injury, because he played round one against Wales, I would have no worries if he didn't play until England.
So in terms of other changes, when you look at the starting 15, and I suppose on paper, any time the Six Nations comes around, you always target that Italy match as, oh, who can get a bit of game time? And obviously we've discussed the number 10, but elsewhere, where do you think the big calls for Andy Farrell will be?
Look, I'd love to see James Lowe starting the left wing. I'd love to see Robert Ballacloon starting the right wing, and that's nothing against Conway or Mac Hansen, who I think have been excellent. It's just to see who are the best options for England and Scotland and further on. And I think particularly Lowe, you know, he scored a great try the weekend against the Ospreys off the bench. He looked in great condition. What he adds to the Irish team is he's a left-footed kicker. And if you think back to the France game, our kicking game was quite poor. There's a lot of pressure on Gibson Park, who's not a natural kicker, and Joey Carberry, who is, because we don't have that third kicking option. So I think you put James Lowe into that team, that takes the pressure off your 9 and 10. It makes it harder for the defence to cover the backfield. And also Lowe gives you a lot in terms of his unpredictability, his offloading game, his power and size. So, you know, and let's not forget, he was a key man for us in November, and probably would have been starting against Wales if he hadn't had that injury from the last Leinster game. So for me, I would love to see him in. And the problem for Ireland at the moment is, like, our bench isn't inexperienced. So against France, we brought on Keane Healy, Conor Murray, Peter Manny. So giving them game time against France, it's only for game time for them rather than testing them out, trying to find new talent. So, but I could also see why Farrell would give them game time, because this is the game to play them in this block. So, yeah, I'd expect a few changes, but nothing drastic.
And in the pack, then, is it more the same? In terms of how tactically Ireland will operate, I assume it will be very similar. It will just be with a few different faces. So, again, you mentioned kind of the experience there. I know I mentioned Tom O'Toole, who might have been in their belts, Finlay Beelam as well, who mightn't be necessarily household names with a bunch of experience, but it might just rejig the pack somewhat to just get a few fresh faces and to get a few more minutes.
Yeah, I think that's it. It'll be players from within the match 23s that we've seen. So, as you said, the likes of Beelam, maybe Healy, obviously Dan Sheehan will start now, and Rob Herring will come on the bench. Henderson is out with COVID, so you know, they'll find a replacement to him. Maybe Ryan Baird will come in, and partner James Ryan. They might put Tyke Byrne to six. There's lots of little changes he can make without really upsetting things. And as you mentioned, Shane, the attacking system is very much embedded now. So no matter who plays, they should be able to play the same way and just add their own individual strengths to it. So I would expect Ireland to have a comfortable win. Michael Bradley did the RT podcast this week, and he gave a brilliant insight into Italian rugby and the challenges they have and what they need to do to get better. And until they do that, there's going to be no shocks or miracles. And you know, we'll get the four tries and the bonus point. It's just a matter of how many points we can pick up.
Where are Italy at the moment? You know, you mentioned Michael Bradley, and a man who has vast coaching experience across Europe as well, so no better man to really kind of give his input on. But obviously Italy have a new coach, and it's always hard to difficult to gauge to where they are, because they seem to fluctuate quite a lot. They'll have one good performance, they can't back it up, and then you go back and look at the club teams not doing so well. So where are they for you now, I suppose, a very broad question.
Yeah, look at the positive is they've, for the last couple of years, they've had a very good under-20s team. They beat England last week. They were very competitive in the Six Nations. That was postponed. That was played in Cardiff over in June. The problem is that those young players are going into environments where they're not winning. Okay, and that breaks their confidence. And then if you're not winning for your club team, even though I know Benetton have won a few games this year, but in general they don't compete at the top level, and Zebra certainly don't. They go into Six Nations and they know that if you're pooling together the best of two teams who don't win regularly, it's very difficult to beat the likes of England, France, Ireland, Scotland or Wales. So that's the issue. I would be in favour of them trying to get their best players out of Italy, try to have 10 or 11 players coming back into national camp with different ideas, more confidence, believing in themselves, and that spreading to the group who are at home, who are coming from the domestic game. But obviously then you've also got 10 more players playing week in, week out, that have added to the depth chart. With only two teams, it's very difficult, unless they're two very strong teams, which obviously Edinburgh and Scotland, or Edinburgh and Glasgow, have really improved their level of competition, and hence the national team looks stronger.
Okay. You mentioned Italy beat England 6-0 there in the under-20s. Ireland play Italy on tomorrow evening, I should say, down in Musgrave Park at 8 p.m. Richie Murphy has made four changes to the side that won against France, with Shea Mullins, Jude Postlethwaite, Fionn Gibbons and Matthew Devine all coming into the starting 15. I suppose just briefly touching on that one, Bernard. Would you read too much into the Italy victory? It was a low-scoring match, difficult conditions, and we'd expect a victory here and a couple of bright young talents on the horizon for Ireland.
Yeah, look, we've been blessed over the last 4 or 5 years with the under-20s and some of the characters and some of the personalities and talents that have come through that. Craig Casey, obviously, is all the way from 20s to the senior team. And this group looked like they weren't actually highly touted beforehand, but listen, speaking of some of the coaches, they've really gelled quickly. Obviously that massive win against Wales was huge, but that's probably not the litmus test. But going away to France and getting a last minute win is massive, and it's totally different than the senior team. The senior team can maybe try a few things this weekend in terms of personnel, whereas Italy are honestly a good barometer of under 20s level, so they'd have to be under game, but I would expect them to definitely get a win and, you know, keep that Grand Slam dream alive.
Okay, well, definitely, hopefully. Very, very briefly, Bernard, just Lens are in action tomorrow evening. Dan Levy will make his return from a wrist injury for Leinster in tomorrow night's URC clash against the Lions at the RDS. So it's great to see Dan Levy back. And also a bit of transfer news for Leinster. Jason Jenkins has been finally confirmed. I think that was one of the best kept secrets. So I don't know whether I'm putting two and two together here and getting five that I might see Devon Toner stepping away at the end of the year.
Devon is going to finish up, from what I understand, and Leinster are going, there's going to be a bit of turnover in Leinster. There's a, you know, a couple of guys leaving. Josh Murphy gone to Connacht. Sean Crone, I think, is packing it in, and there's a few other lads maybe on the move as well. Jack Dunn to Exeter. So Jenkins is coming in for Munster. Look, Jenkins is a quality player. He's just been unbelievably unlucky with injury.
Yeah.
And everybody has said to Leo Cullen, you need that big enforcer type second row. You know, the Estebet, the Luda Jager. And those guys are very expensive.
Malcolm O'Kelly,
yeah, maybe, yeah. But get him out of retirement. But Jenkins, if Jenkins can get fit, he's obviously fit. If he can stay injury free,
yeah.
I think he's a really nice profile for those big games in Europe when you're playing a La Rochelle or a Toulouse or a Clermont and you're up against a monster pack. He will allow the likes of James Ryan, Caelan Doris, etc., do what they do best, and very good scrummager, very good maul, attacking maul and defensive maul, and just, I think he's a good signing, and obviously Leinster just hope they're a little bit more lucky with injuries than he was in Munster.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned Malcolm McCulley there because I saw Jason Jenkins. He's like a throwback to your Bob Casey's or Leo Cullen himself even as well. So it's nice to see a bit of old school rugby as well. Jerseys might get a bit baggier and playing back in Donnybrook and so on and so forth. Anyway, listen, Bernard Shackman, thank you very much. Hopefully we will have a bit of Irish team news tomorrow that we'll be bringing you on tomorrow evening's Game On. But for now, we will turn our attention to American football in a few moments' time. We'll have Jeff Shepherd on. Stay with us.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Hello, once again, you're listening to Game On. I'm Shane Dawson. It is Thursday evening, and it is great to have your company. Paul Corrie is still live in studio with me, keeping an eye on Bodø/Glimt Celtic, and we'll hear from Jeff Shepherd very shortly with all things going on in American sports. Paul, I was going to ask you to give us an update, but sure, the second half has only kicked off as well, so Bodø/Glimt are still winning against Celtic at home 1-0. It is 4-1 on aggregate to Bodø/Glimt, so things not looking good for Celtic, and in truth, it could be, I say, 2 or 3-1, judging on a couple of first half chances. But Paul, there is one game on this evening in the Premier League as well, Arsenal against Wolves, and I think teams are in, not to be putting you on the spot, but as I see there, Ramsdale and goal, White, Gabriel Martinelli is back, like I said, up top, Saka on the other wing as well. Looking forward to this one.
It's a big game, Shane, and it's probably one that's gone under the radar a bit with everything that's been going on, particularly in the Champions League. But Arsenal and Wolves have been making strides in the last number of weeks towards that top four space. And just looking at the table there, you know, they sit 4 points behind Manchester United with 3 games in hand. So if they were to win tonight, it brings them within a point. But Wolves will certainly prove a difficult test. They've been in really good form of late. Good win against Leicester on the weekend. And they beat Tottenham 2-0 before that. So they don't concede many goals. Daniel Podence has been really good of late, in particular for Wolves in that front line. But something tells me that Arsenal just have a bit more steel about them this season. They're certainly keeping a lot more clean sheets. That back three of Ramsdale, Ben White and Gabriel certainly solved a number of the problems that they have had, and you just fancy them to maybe beat Wolves again tonight. They did play only the 10th of February in that 1-0 game that Martinelli got sent off in. So it's a quick turnaround that can sometimes spring up a few tricky results, but I think this is there for Arsenal, and I have a funny feeling that Arsenal could pip Man U to that top four spot. I'm really not convinced by Manchester United in the league. They haven't really played anybody difficult on their rang. They're probably better suited to the cup competitions, and I just fancy Arsenal. I think they've got enough about them.
Okay, so no Man United for the league, but you were tipping for the Champions League earlier, yeah?
Well, absolutely not, that I'm putting words in your mouth there. Absolutely not for the Champions League.
Semi-final, final, did you say?
I said a semi-final. I just have a feeling that they're going to get through against Atletico and then cough up maybe one of the more favourable draws of Villarreal, a Juve or Benfica or Ajax, but I'm certainly not calling them for the competition.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. Okay, well, that is Arsenal Wolves this evening, and Paul, you'll be keeping an eye on Bodø/Glimt against Celtic. It's in the 50th minute at the moment, still 1-0. But we will welcome Jeff Shepherd into the conversation. Jeff, how are you, sir? The last time we were talking was post-Super Bowl and you were still getting over the excitement of it all. In the meantime, what is happening over in the USA? I want to start with Tom Brady, actually, because... I'll let you take over from here. So he's gone from football star to movie superstar?
I mean... Look, he's a very handsome fellow, you know, so I mean, I think it makes sense. But yeah, his first, I guess, kind of post-retirement move is going to be from, you know, South Florida, Central Florida to Southern Los Angeles and Hollywood. He's going to be involved in and help produce a movie that stars. And look, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, this is pretty heavy hitters in the world of, you know, entertainment. You got Lily Tomlin, Rita Moreno, Jane Fonda, and Sally Field. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. He's going to play in this movie, and the premise of the movie is basically these women are lifelong friends who get together and go travel to a Super Bowl to go watch Tom Brady play in the Super Bowl. I mean, it's almost, is it a little like Inception? I'm not exactly sure. You know, he's going to be in it. But so, look, he gets to play quarterback. So, you know, maybe he keeps the arm in shape. And, you know, maybe he recruits Gronk to be in the movie with him and he keeps working out with Gronk. I mean, are you catching where I'm going here, Shane?
I do, absolutely.
We may not see the last of him on a football field is where I'm going here, you know?
Okay. Okay. You're alluding to it in a very politically sensitive manner there. You know, you're doing very well. Good PR man you are, Shep. Because listen, it's not off the top of my head. I suppose off the top of my head, we've seen, Michael Jordan star in a few films, didn't he? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was in. Vinnie Jones as well. So, like, I mean, he's not the first.
No, he's certainly not the first. I don't think he'll be the last. And look, I mean, again, like I'm saying, he's probably going to pull in some of his buddies, you know, to make the football scenes a little bit more realistic. You know what the sad part is? Is I'm sitting back here and I'm trying to remember which Super Bowl that was, because he's played in 10 of them. And I honestly, you know, I couldn't tell you which one it was. I mean, it's so, you know, it's so ridiculous that maybe that might be the Falcons one when they blew the lead. You know, I mean, I would have to go back and look it up because he's got 10 of them.
I know, he does have a lot. But listen, sticking with American football, even in an off-season when Ben Roethlisberger and Tom Brady decided to retire, and I say retire in inverted brackets now, possibly, Aaron Rodgers is still dominating headlines. The four-time NFL MVP has a big decision to make about his future, and as all fans can talk about, he can decide indeed to join Big Ben and Brady in retirement. He could choose to play another year with the Packers, or he could take his talents to another franchise. But late on Monday night, I think it was, Rodgers published a lengthy Instagram post which centred around gratitude. It said nothing specific about his future, but definitely looked like something someone would share if they were retiring or possibly leaving their team.
Look, Shane, we have talked about Aaron Rodgers' shenanigans for the last year, and we've also talked about him on the football field some too. It's been, you know, few and far between, but it's been a lot more, you know, kind of the off-field drama. But yeah, he came up with this big long post the other night, and one of the interesting things that I think everybody was kind of, you know how it is, somebody posts something on social media and then everybody has to start reading into it. What did they mean? And what does this mean? And he posted a photo of Devontae Adams and Randall Cobb standing next to each other during the national anthem. There was space in between him. Well, that's where Rodgers typically stands in the during the national anthem in the pregame warm-up. It's just kind of part of their ritual. And, you know, he didn't play in the Chiefs game because he had COVID and he had tested positive. Which was another part of the melodrama from this year. And folks were kind of reading into it saying, you know, he's not going to be there anymore. And he went on a radio show this week and said, actually, it was just a really moving photo. You know, it meant a lot to me that the guys would go out of their way to continue our tradition, even though I wasn't there. And so we've also got rumors of a breakup with the fiance, the actress Shailene Woodley, or maybe they're not. I mean, it's just all over the map. Most quarterbacks don't like to have this much drama in their life, and it just seems like he cannot stay away from it.
Oh, I know. Listen, Shep, even in the off-season, you bring us all the biggest stories from America, so I do appreciate it, and hopefully we'll catch up again next week, and hopefully you'll have some more sports and movie-related stories. Who knows? Jeff Shepherd, thank you very much. Paul Curry, just before we go, in a word, 54th minute on the clock, will Celtic score? Is there any hope of getting anything from this fixture, never mind the tie?
Yeah, they've certainly stepped it up a gear. They've brought McGregor and Abada on at half-time, and they look like they've got a bit more going forward. They had a half shout for a penalty and they've gotten in behind once or twice down Liam Scales' side to create some chances, but the gap is too much now. There's three goals there, Shane. It's too much to come back from.
Yeah, absolutely unfortunate for Celtic fans. Shane, that is all we have time for Game On this evening. I did promise a Paddy Clifford interview at the top of the show, and unfortunately time got away from us, but do get onto Game On social media channels and you'll be able to get it on the Game On podcast feed later on this evening. Until tomorrow, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much to Bernie Jackman, Paul Corrie, and indeed to Jeff Shepherd. Laura Lee Davis was your broadcast coordinator. Ronan Lawler was the producer. Tara Kumar is up next.
RTE 2FM.
Game On.
On 2FM.
With Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.